The letter N. Near-death experiences. I wouldn't know where to begin to count the number of books, studies, debates, societies, TV specials, research projects, theological forums, etc., 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 that have been devoted to the subject of near-death experiences. The overwhelming focus: are near-death experiences real? And I have to say, there's one fact about near-death experiences among all that noise that's irrefutable. I've never met or heard of anyone who's actually had one, including me, who doesn't know it was real. So while the scientific, theological, and philosophical skepticism rages on, some respect, please, for those of us with involuntary, firsthand expertise. I've told parts of my near-death experience in other segments of this program, but here's the whole thing. I was 42 years old. I'd had major surgery, and there were catastrophic post-operative complications to the point where my family and close friends were keeping a 24-hour vigil around my hospital bed. There were four or five of them there when my body temperature suddenly dropped like a rock, my heart stopped, and by every physiological definition in any medical dictionary you can name, I was dead. I've talked to a lot of fellow near-death survivors who were mesmerized by the realization that they'd left their bodies and could hover above themselves, eavesdropping on what everyone in the room was saying and doing now that they were gone. You might want to bear that in mind when and if you find yourself at someone's deathbed. Just because they're dead doesn't mean they're not listening to every word you say. I, on the other hand, was apparently in sprinter's position to get out of there and couldn't have been less interested in hovering. When you listen to the tunnel section, you'll find that it doesn't descend toward us from up in the sky somewhere. It actually rises from the etheric substance of our own bodies at maybe a 20 or 30 degree angle, and instead of leading up, it leads across to home on the other side. That isn't far away beyond the clouds where happy little bluebirds fly, but is really right here, only 3 feet above our ground level, in another dimension with a much higher vibrational frequency than ours. As I moved through the tunnel, I remember thinking that even on the best, happiest, healthiest day of the lifetime I was leaving behind, I'd never felt as alive as I felt now that I was dead and free of that inconvenient albatross of a body that had conked out and was of no further use to me. I was thriving, I was free, I was exhilarated, and I knew without giving it any conscious thought that everyone and everything I'd ever worried about was perfect, exactly as it was meant to be. I didn't consciously wonder about eternity at some specific moment in the tunnel, but I became filled with a peaceful, certain truth of it, which included the knowledge that my loved ones on Earth would be with me again in what would seem like no time at all. I had no sense of leaving a life behind me. Instead, there was a thrilling sense of returning to a life that brought me endless joy. The legendary white light appeared ahead of me. Its brilliance is sacred, and its penetrating, welcoming purity somehow contains all the wisdom that ever was and ever will be. A figure stepped into the large opening at the end of the tunnel. At first, it was just a silhouette against the brilliant light. As I got closer, I could make out the features of my cherished Grandma Ada, who'd gone home when I was 18 and whom I'd missed every minute of every day since then. I joyfully cried out her name without making a sound, and she smiled back with indescribable love. I could see a meadow beyond her through the opening at the end of the tunnel, grassy and filled with flowers, with earthly colors enriched and magnified by a thousand. And then two things happened at exactly the same moment. I reached out my hand to Grandma Ada, and she reached out her hand to me, but her fingers were pointing upward, with her palm toward me, in a gesture meaning, "Stop." I kept reaching for her, either not understanding or refusing to, and I was a breath away from touching her, during which I clearly heard the distant voice of one of the friends who'd been standing at my hospital bed when I left. It was a plea so urgent she almost shrieked, "Sylvia, don't go, you're so needed." At the sound of those words, you would have thought a giant rubber band had been stretched to its limit around my waist. One instant, I was about to take my beloved grandmother's hand and step through the glorious threshold to the other side. The next instant, I was snapped away from her and home and slammed back into that weak, painful, leaden body in that cold, sterile hospital room, staring into weeping, agonized faces that surrounded my bed. I tried my best to be philosophical, to be thankful I was back because it was clearly for a worthy purpose, but the truth is, I was angry, frustrated, and depressed about it for weeks afterwards. In the long run, though, in the many years since, I've cherished the opportunity to hear countless near-death experiences of clients, friends, and colleagues from every faith and every continent on this planet, not as a curious researcher and regressive hypnotist, but as someone who's been there too. And without exception, we all share a gift no skeptic could ever diminish, no matter how snide and superior they might try to be. It was put perfectly by the late poet, pacifist, and international treasure, Matti Stepanek, whose passing in 2004, at the age of 13, left the world poorer for his absence, but infinitely richer for his having been here at all. I had the great pleasure of appearing on Larry King Live with Matti. At one point, Larry King asked Matti, who'd had a near-death experience of his own, if he was afraid of death. Matti Stepanek, then 11, with the peaceful smile of an angel, answered for each and every one of us who's ever come back from an instant in the presence of that light. "I'm afraid of dying," he said, "but I'm not afraid of death."